Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Denver Metro News. My name is Dave Dell. Today, I'll be reading articles from Denverite and Westward. From Denverite, I'll be reading, Denver International Airport is adding flights to Istanbul on Turkish Airlines, by Rebecca Tauber. And Bell Cherry Hills promised luxurious and secure living. Residents say they got overflowing trash, broken doors, and fire hazards instead. Also by Rebecca Tauber. From Westward, I'll be reading, Denver homeless nonprofit quietly opens new micro-community, replaces CEO, by Benito L. Kelty. And Denver Police Dream Center tackling Ogden crime with holistic patrols, by Chris Perez. I'll finish up the hour with other articles from Westward. These first two articles are from Denverite. Denver International Airport is adding flights to Istanbul on Turkish Airlines, by Rebecca Tauber. Denverites will be able to fly direct to Istanbul on Turkish Airlines starting on June 11th, Denver International Airport announced Thursday. Turkish Airlines is the latest in a slew of airlines and routes DIA has added in the past few years as the airport continues its rapid growth. In 2023, the airport added flights to Monterrey, Mexico and Dublin, Ireland, while United continues to grow its flights out of Denver as well. The new airline will be the 26th to operate out of DIA, and travelers can start booking flights now. The flights will run on Tuesdays, Saturdays, and Fridays, with the airline adding Sundays in July. Denver is now the 14th city served by the airline in the country. We are strongly committed to growing our presence in the U.S., said Fatih Durmaz, VP of Sales of the Americas for Turkish Airlines. This reflects Turkish Airlines' ambitious growth plans. It connects us to the world, said Denver Mayor Mike Johnston at a press conference on Friday. Turkish Airlines is the most connected airline in the world. Johnston mentioned connections through Turkish Airlines to India, Africa, and the Middle East. He also said the new airline will bring 350 jobs to Denver, with the additional hope that will lead to business connections between Turkish companies and the city in the future. Airport staff estimates that the partnership could bring in more than $54 million in economic revenue to Colorado. The Denver Airport plans to continue adding routes and airlines in the coming years. Airport CEO Phil Washington said booking has gone well with the newer flights, like those to Monterrey and Dublin. According to industry data provided by the airport, passenger demand between Denver and Istanbul has gone up by 50% since 2019. Meanwhile, Airport CEO Phil Washington said that DIA remains in talks about opening up flights to Amsterdam, Cairo, Ethiopia, and other parts of Japan, though timelines on those potential routes are unclear. We are being very, very ambitious in terms of increasing our global connections around the world, Washington said. Bell Cherry Hills promised luxurious and secure living. Residents say they got overflowing trash, broken doors, and fire hazards instead, by Rebecca Tauber. Bell Cherry Hills, an apartment complex just over Denver's southern border in Inglewood, advertises itself as a haven of pure comfort where every element is designed with care. The complex has more than 300 units and boasts a fitness center, a dog park, a controlled access garage, a ski and bike repair shop, and a sparkling swimming pool. But according to residents, the garage and apartment complex doors are often broken, leading to break-ins and thefts. Trash overflows. An elevator is broken. Fire extinguishers are smashed or missing. Fire alarms go off regularly, and electrical wires are exposed in the garage. Until recently, a bike lock closed the pool from the outside, creating a fire hazard. Most of my stuff was a lot of just death by a thousand cuts, tiny frustrations that have built up and up and up, said Eliza Hammond, who has spent the last 2 years trying to get management to fix a number of issues at the complex. Recently, she started reaching out to her neighbors. The more I started to talk to other people on the property, I don't even have it as bad as everyone else does. Complaints at the complex come as the management company, Bell Partners Incorporated, looks to continue expanding nationwide. The North Carolina company already owns and manages 10 properties in Colorado, many of which include online reviews complaining about similar issues to those at Bell Cherry Hills. In 2023, residents at Bell's Broomfield complex complained about wildly fluctuating utility bills. Bloomberg reported in 2023 that the company raised $1.3 billion to buy apartments across the country, targeting 14 cities, including Denver. According to press release from the company in 2023, it plans to focus on multifamily apartments and investment in transitioning neighborhoods. Representatives for Bell Cherry Hills and Bell Partners Incorporated did not respond to Denverites' requests for comment. Residents at the Inglewood location said that they were shown nice apartments when touring the property, only to find a different reality after moving in. Hammond said that when it snows, the sidewalks outside the leasing office and around the front of the complex are completely shoveled. But when residents turn the corner, the sidewalks leading to the main buildings are snow-packed and icy. Gorgeous leasing office. All of the doors and locks getting into the front property work. But if we walk over to Building B, there's broken door handles off there, she said. They've told me, essentially, because it locks and latches, that they don't really have any plans on replacing it. Hammond said her washing machine was broken at one point for 3 weeks, and one of the elevators has currently been broken for 6 weeks. Growing frustrations pushed her to put flyers up around the complex, including on her own door, trying to connect with fellow residents about the maintenance issues at the property. Of course, they rip all those down right away, said Hammond, who shared with Denverite dozens of documents showing issues at the complex and gave a reporter a tour of the complex. Since posting her flyers, Hammond has heard from a number of neighbors about unsafe conditions at the complex, including car and bike thefts. Because garage and other ground-level doors lead directly to apartments, broken doors can lead anyone right inside. A car break-in in the parking garage was Hammond's final straw. She said broken glass covering the ground after the theft remained in the parking garage for weeks. I had 4 or 5 rounds of emails back and forth with them saying, "Hey, this car has been in here with a busted-out window for months and the glass hasn't been cleaned up," she said. And they would just email me back saying, "I've said maintenance out, I've taken care of it." And then I'd be standing right there reading these emails in the broken glass. Jacob Kramer, who connected with Hammond through her flyers, said he also worries about the parking garage. He said management fixed one of the doors only for it to break again a week later. Kramer also said he found exposed wires and broken electrical piping in the garage. The problem with electrical is you may not have an issue or a spark or something right where that is that could go all the way through the wiring and go into a hallway and cause an arc or a spark that can start to fire. And that makes me nervous as someone who's worked in electrical, said Kramer, who used to install solar panels. It's sketchy. It's scary. Meanwhile, rent at the complex has gone up. Hammond pays around $1,700 for a 700-square-foot one-bedroom. But she said that adds up to more than $1,800 per month after fees, which include a $30 monthly trash fee for a service that no longer operates at the complex because of the fire hazard concerns. Kramer said he pays around $2,500 for a two-bedroom. Both residents said their rent has gone up by at least $100 since moving in more than 2 years ago. "As our rent has gone up, the quality of the complex has gone down," Kramer said. Elsewhere in the country, Bell Partners Incorporated has faced a number of lawsuits from tenants and state attorneys general. Valued at more than $18 billion, Bell Partners Incorporated owns and manages apartment buildings across the country, including in California, Texas, North Carolina, Virginia, Georgia, Florida, Washington, and Washington, D.C. The company has also been sued in a number of those states. In Austin, in 2014, the company settled with a number of tenant and disability rights groups for $200,000 over claims of discrimination against deaf tenants. In Virginia, the company was one of 29 landlords sued by the state in 2021 for refusing Section 8 vouchers. Also that year, tenants in North Carolina won a $4.75 million class action settlement claiming the company charged them illegal eviction fees. And in November of 2023, the Washington, D.C. Attorney General sued Bell Partners Incorporated and 13 other landlords claiming the companies colluded to inflate rent using a property management software. Fed up with waiting months for maintenance, both Kramer and Hammond are planning to move out early. Hammond said she sent management a demand letter and that they waived her early move-out fees, which could have cost her thousands of dollars. But even moving out will be complicated because of the broken freight elevator. I will be renting a very long bed pickup truck that could fit my couch and bed so I can get it up to the parking garage so I can get my stuff out on account of the elevator not working and there not being a timeline for it to be fixed, Kramer said. The following articles are from Westword. Denver homeless nonprofit quietly opens new micro-community, replaces CEO, by Benito L. Kelty. Denver's largest homeless service provider for the transgender and non-binary communities has been busy since February, opening a new micro-community while also replacing its CEO. The Gathering Place is one of the three nonprofits tapped by the City of Denver to run a micro-community, a grouping of shack-like units for people to transition out of homelessness. According to the organization and the Mayor Mike Johnston's office, people quietly began moving into the site at 1375 Aladi Street in the Golden Triangle on March 20th. Aladi Village, as the 44-unit micro-community is known, extends the Gathering Place's mission by serving only women, transgender, and non-binary homeless residents, mostly from encampments. When the site opened privately 2 weeks ago, it did so under new leadership at the Gathering Place, as former CEO Megan Devenport left in February. The Gathering Place didn't announce Devenport's departure, but announced the appointment of interim CEO Heather Beck in a February 21st press release, adding that her promotion takes place as the organization is aligning around a renewed vision of services and programming. The Gathering Place won't comment on Devenport's departure. As a matter of policy, the Gathering Place does not discuss personnel matters, says Caitlin Cook, Vice President of Development for the Gathering Place. Devenport did not respond to requests for comment. This leadership change did not affect the operation of Aladi Village, Cook says. Heather has been the primary service lead on this project from the beginning and remains in that role. According to Cook, Beck was appointed because her vision for Aladi Village lines up better with the mission of the Gathering Place. She has been central to developing our expanded program model for the last 4 years and is now leading the program model for Aladi Village in collaboration with currently and formerly unhoused people and community partners, Cook says of Beck. Mayor Johnston held a groundbreaking for the site in early November of 2023, with Denver City Council approving a $1.5 million contract with the Gathering Place, which had planned to open in December. However, like the rest of the House 1000 sites, the opening was delayed several times. The Aladi Village began welcoming residents who were moved out of encampments by the city in phases on March 20th. The City of Denver did not announce the site opening publicly in order to protect the community and residents it serves, according to Jose Salas, a spokesperson for the mayor's office. The director of residential programs for the Gathering Place, Duana Powell, said the majority of our participants in Aladi Village are part of the Encampment Resolution Initiative. Some of our clients are also being referred from various community agencies assisting unhoused individuals. As of Monday, April 1st, the site still had room to take in more residents. People are continuing to be referred and moved in, according to the Gathering Place. Denver's Department of Housing Stability is managing referrals, with encampments being the main referrals. According to the Gathering Place, Beck led the efforts to develop the program model for Aladi Village, which is said to offer its homeless residents case management, housing navigation, supportive services, and wellness programs to support members' transition into permanent housing. Beyond Aladi Village, Beck is helping us crystallize and codify the renewed vision of services and programming for the organization as a whole, the Gathering Place said in its February 21st press release. Our services have grown exponentially over the past several years. We've changed from only a drop-in day shelter to a more comprehensive care model, including housing with lower barriers to care. We've widened our mission to include non-binary and trans people, Cook says. As we make all these changes, we are renewing our vision and are grateful to have Heather Beck's leadership during this transition. In her four-year tenure, she has shown that she is a leader that is well-suited to help us make these changes. Devonport worked as the CEO of The Gathering Place for a year. Her LinkedIn profile says that she left her position in February. She currently works as an adjunct professor for the University of Denver Graduate School of Social Work and as an affiliate professor with Metro State University, according to LinkedIn. In the months before signing on to run a micro-community, The Gathering Place had been dealing with a homeless encampment surrounding its main offices at 1535 High Street. Nearby residents complained that Devonport wasn't doing enough after telling her directly about fears of violence and vandalism, which led Denver police to carry out what they called a soft sweep in September. From 2020 to 2023, The Gathering Place ran a 24/7 non-congregate shelter for women, transgender, and non-binary homeless individuals at the former Roadway Inn Motel at 4765 Federal Boulevard. As many as 140 people found housing after staying at the shelter before it shut down in early 2023, when the Denver Housing Authority decided not to renew its contract with the organization and repurpose the property into permanent housing, according to The Gathering Place. The Gathering Place brings in between $3 million and $4 million in contributions each year, according to tax records. This is relatively small for a local homelessness nonprofit, but The Gathering Place is one of two nonprofits dedicated to transgender and non-binary homeless residents, along with the Dolores Project, which receives about the same in annual contributions. Beck worked as the Vice President of Programs and Services for The Gathering Place for almost 5 years. Before that, she worked with the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless, a major statewide player in homeless resources, for 22 years. Elizabeth Ferguson, Board Chair for The Gathering Place, says that Devonport's departure and Beck's appointment won't change the organization's commitment to serving the women, transgender, and non-binary folks and children who need support while they are experiencing poverty, according to a press release. That is central to who we are and will not change, Ferguson says. But as we take this time to re-envision how to best serve this community, we are grateful for the vision and stability Heather Beck will provide. The only micro-community that opened in 2023 was a 54-unit site near the Stay Inn at 12033 East 38th Avenue in Central Park. In early March, the city opened La Paz, a 60-unit micro-community at 2301 South Santa Fe Drive in the Overland neighborhood that will be run by the Colorado Village Collaborative. Although the city of Denver has no other plans to open a new micro-community, plans for a micro-community in the Baker neighborhood at 950 West Alameda Avenue are still in limbo, with the city having already done some digging at the location, but not moving further than that. Aladi Village is in the middle of the Golden Triangle Creative District. This neighborhood was once the only one where Johnston had two micro-communities planned, but nixed plans for one shortly after two town hall discussions with Golden Triangle residents. Denver Police Dream Center Tackling Ogden Crime with Holistic Patrols by Chris Perez. Residents, business owners, and police officials gathered at the Emerson School in Capitol Hill on Thursday, March 28th, to discuss possible solutions for the crime and drug situation on Ogden Street between 14th and Colfax Avenues. One of the main solutions, starting April 8th, Officers with the Denver Police Department will begin conducting patrols in the area 2 days a week, 8 hours a day, for the next several months. They'll be using a holistic approach to policing the area, teaming up with the Denver Dream Center to make contact with people who appear to be causing problems or suffering from issues like substance abuse or mental health conditions. While arrests can occur when law violations are observed by DPD officers or Dream Center staff, the grant fueling these extra patrols is focused on outreach and providing services and support, according to DPD officials. The Denver Police Department will use a method supported by the academic literature to co-produce public safety with community groups and faith-based organizations, says a grant application from DPD. The program would involve pairing 1 to 2 officers with 1 to 2 members of a community or faith-based organization to perform foot patrols in locations where the data indicates chronic violent crime. Between September 2023 and February 2024, more than 110 criminal offenses were reported on this stretch of Ogden, according to the DPD crime map. There were multiple reports of assaults, robberies, auto theft, disorderly conduct, and public drug/alcohol use at all hours. Westward detailed the crime situation in a February 1st article with staff and owners of businesses in the area, such as the Corner Beat, Balanced Root Apothecary, Rooted Heart Yoga, and Wellness and Glam House, and detailed how they struggle to make patrons and workers feel safe. Violent crime has seen a 0% change since last year on Ogden Street between Colfax and 14th on a year-over-year basis, according to DPD, while property crime is down by 27%, with there being 10 fewer property crime offenses this year than last year. However, resource technicians for DPD District 6 provided a crime update at the March 28th town hall showing that overall crime is up since 2023. In total, 21 more crimes have been reported in this area as of late March, with a 142% increase in drug offenses. Police conducted 74 arrests in the area, a 31.3% increase over the same span in 2023. According to DPD, 80% of the arrests so far this year are drug or alcohol related. Since January, 22 firearms have been recovered by police in the area between 14th and Colfax on Ogden, according to District 6 officials. The department hopes that patrols with the Dream Center will lead to decreases in criminal activity as a whole. Involving community members in improving the neighborhoods where they live and work will improve community police relations and reduce crime in the identified neighborhoods, the grant application says. The goals of this project are to reduce crime and create better partnerships between DPD and residents. The grant and funding for the DPD patrols, which are scheduled for Mondays and Fridays during the day, are paid out as overtime and considered congressional direct spending by the Bureau of Justice Assistance. The total grant award was $122,000, according to the DPD, with $18,320 contracted to the Dream Center, a faith-based nonprofit, and $103,680 set aside for officer overtime for DPD District 6 and DPD District 2. The patrols are going to be conducted near Colfax and Broadway in the 500 block of East Colfax, in addition to the 1400 block of Ogden. We're hoping that will provide some relief in this area, District 6 Community Resource Officer Kayla Nabe said during the town hall. Property and business owners in the area, as well as residents, lobbied questions and statements at Nabe and others in attendance at the town hall, including District 10 City Councilman Chris Hines, asking for specifics about the DPD patrols and efforts being made by everyone involved. One business owner, who did not provide her name, thanked cops for their efforts, but noted that although people in the area, including herself, might feel all happy and fuzzy right now, she's afraid the kumbaya moment won't last. I just want to make sure we're going to keep moving in this direction, she said. It's like crime goes away temporarily, but then are they going to come back like cockroaches? According to the DPD, The extra patrols are expected to last until mid-August. For the grant, specifically, we only have a certain amount of money that's been allotted, Nabe explained to Westward after the town hall. We have been in talks with Colfax Business Improvement District on trying to figure out how to increase security in the area. Down on the 16th Street Mall, the downtown partnership, they have a security team, and then they also hire off-duty officers to help supplement that security. Frank Locantor, executive director of the Colfax Business Improvement District, told Westward last month that meetings were being held between him, the DPD, Hines, and Mayor Mike Johnson's office to discuss potential sources of crime and substance use on the 1400 block of Ogden. The mayor's office is working closely with DPD, DOTI, Councilman Chris Hines' office, and the Colfax BID to identify potential solutions for the community members and businesses along that stretch of Ogden, Mayoral Press Secretary Jordan Fuha said in a statement last month. Having uniformed cops and marked DPD vehicles conducting extra patrols on multiple blocks along East Colfax is an idea that city and police officials are both behind, with officers out on foot making contact with businesses, making contact with folks out in the area, according to Nabi. Police will be tracking crime data in the patrol areas over the next few months to see what sort of impact they're having, DPD adds. Hopefully, that will show a reduction in crime, Nabi said. And if that's the case, we're hoping that maybe we can find other grant money to help supplement that goal, either through the city or through CBID, Colfax BID, or through other organizations. Which excuses work and don't for disputing express lane violations? By Hannah Metzger. Did you receive one of the 231,000 notices for violations on Colorado express lanes issued since last June? Odds are, you're going to have to pay up. From June 2023 through March 8th, only 3,921 people successfully had their fines dismissed, just over 17.6% of the 22,216 people who tried disputing the citations, according to data from the Colorado Department of Transportation. Around 900 others are still awaiting hearings. Drivers who cross the solid lines of express lanes on C-470, I-25, and the I-70 Mountain Corridor are hit with a $75 fine, doubling to $150 after 20 days without payment. For I-70, violations also include using the toll lane when closed or while driving an oversized vehicle. But almost all fines are issued for entering or exiting the lanes at non-designated areas, said CDOT spokesperson Tim Hoover. Nearly half of the drivers who disputed their express lane violations gave the same excuse. I was forced onto the express lane. But fewer than one in five people who claimed to be forced into the lane got their fines dismissed. While it was the most popular defense, it was the third least effective. We would review evidence and find that they were following too closely, and when the car in front of them was braking, they swerved around them to get into the express lane, Hoover says. In some instances, we actually had people saying, they just weren't going fast enough, so I was forced into the express lane. That's not how that works. Over 9,700 disputers claimed that they were forced into the express lane. Of them, 1,848 successfully had their fines dismissed, including in instances when a collision occurred in front of them or first responders redirected traffic into the express lane. Most of the unsuccessful claims went more like this. I was forced to enter the express lane due to nearby cars driving recklessly and under the minimum speed limit, one driver wrote in a report disputing a fine. The reckless driving caused me anxiety, and I wanted to remove myself from it. Hoover says the forced into the express lane option was so widely misused that the state removed it as a category in December. However, most of those arguments were just diverted to the general other category. Another top excuse in the other category came from people arguing that they were not driving when their vehicle illegally crossed the express lane line. As it turns out, that doesn't matter either, because the state won't accept it as a valid reason to get out of the fine. The owner is responsible, Hoover explains. We don't know who is driving the car. We just know that the car committed a violation. You're the owner, and you're responsible for the violation. It's like a parking ticket. Some of these disputers claimed they rented out their car using apps like Turo when the vehicle committed the violation. Others blamed their friends and family members. That was my birthday, which means it was my designated driver driving, not me, one person wrote in their unsuccessful dispute. I had no say in what she chose to do regarding the express lane. Overall, the least successful defense for those disputing their fines was, I have never owned this vehicle, resulting in dismissed fines only 12.5% of the time. That was followed by other, with 15.9% success rate, and I was forced into the express lane at 19%. Other common failed excuses, it was an accident. We were following Google Maps. Other people were doing it too. There are several cars driving in the express lane. I got confused. It was dark and I panicked. And I didn't know there was a fine for that. I'm new to Colorado. One disputer said the vehicle crossed the solid line because a passenger had to vomit, but at least he was able to get the door open for most of it. Colorado's first-of-its-kind enforcement program uses sensors and cameras to catch drivers who cross the solid lines of express lanes, whether they're swerving in and out to avoid paying the toll or using the lane to pass another vehicle. Enforcement began in October for I-25 and C-470 and June for the I-70 mountain corridor. One Colorado driver has collected 75 violations, totaling $9,675 in fines, according to CDOT. Another driver has 72 violations. The penalties for these violations are civil, so they don't come with any criminal charges or points taken off a driver's license. But if the fines go unpaid long enough, drivers can get a hold placed on their vehicle registration, making them unable to renew. Though that hasn't happened yet, plenty of vehicle owners have had to ante up. I frankly don't understand how there hasn't been a hold placed yet, Hoover says of the drivers with over 70 violations. As of March 3rd, the state has issued 231,357 notices of express lane violations, 106,245 on I-25, 97,376 on C-470, and 27,736 on the I-70 mountain corridor. Some excuses actually work, often from situations much worse than a $75 fine. The top three was the vehicle owner is dead with a 69.4% success rate. The vehicle was stolen, which worked 69.3% of the time. And I no longer own this vehicle at 59.7%. Colorado could approve warnings, parental oversight for kids on social media by Hannah Metzger. Scrolling through TikTok could soon look a lot different for young people in Colorado, even if the federal government doesn't ban the app. Colorado lawmakers are considering three bills that would change the way children use social media, including age verification requirements and timed pop-up warnings about the impacts of social media use on mental health, as well as tools for parents that limit their child's access to features like appearance-altering filters, endless scrolling, and private messaging. Our kids can't wait. We can't sit by and let the harms of social media continue to mount, says State Senator Daphne Michelson-Jeanette, a sponsor of one of the bills. We know what will make it better. What we need is the courage to get to work and change the world our kids are growing up in. Nearly 40% of Colorado high schoolers reported feeling sad or hopeless almost every day for prolonged periods in the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment's most recent Healthy Kids Colorado survey in 2021. From 2016 to 2021, the rate of young Coloradans who reported poor mental health more than doubled, and the children's emergency room visits for mental health reasons increased by 140% compared to just 23% for adults, according to the 2023 Kids Count in Colorado report. The report partially attributes this decline in youth mental health to increased use of social media. Nationally, children and teenagers who spend more than 3 hours a day on social media face double the risk of mental health problems, according to the U.S. Surgeon General. Michelson-Jeanette's measure, Senate Bill 158, would create a proposed age verification and parental tool requirements. Specifics on how social media platforms would verify a user's age would be determined by the Colorado Attorney General's office. Starting in July of 2025, if a user is found to be a minor, the bill would require platforms to provide the user and their parent or guardian with tools to restrict how long the child can spend on the platform while also limiting access to specific features. Parents could also request to receive notifications when their children interact with an adult user's account and when their kids' accounts post or interact with sexually exploitive material. The child would be notified when their parents has these kinds of settings in place, too. In addition, the bill would prohibit users of all ages from promoting or selling illegal firearms, illicit substances, or sexually exploitive material involving minors on social media platforms. According to the legislation, platforms would have to remove any user engaging in this activity and set specific timetables for complying with law enforcement inquiries. In every single jurisdiction in Colorado, we see drugs and guns being traded over social media to and between juveniles, Boulder District Attorney Michael Doherty said while testifying in support of the bill during a March 28th Senate committee hearing. And we also see children being exploited and sex trafficked through social media. It's happening in every jurisdiction across the state. Besides Doherty, the bill is backed by district attorneys of Denver, Arapahoe County, El Paso County, and Jefferson County, as well as 19 organizations, including Children's Hospital Colorado, the Association of Chiefs of Police, the Colorado Education Association, and the Colorado Psychiatric Society. But not everyone is on board. The bill initially received major pushback from marijuana groups, who argued it would lead to social media users being banned for posting about marijuana, even though the drug is legal in Colorado. The bill was amended on March 28th to exempt marijuana products from the illicit substance ban. With that change, the bill's primary opponents, Clear Cannabis and Clintel Capital, also revoked their opposition. However, the amendment didn't address medical psilocybin, which is now legal in Colorado, or the natural psychedelic substances that Coloradans voted to decriminalize in 2022. This bill threatens my livelihood and First Amendment rights, Ashley Troxell, a psychedelic guide in Denver, said during the March committee hearing. By making it illegal for social media platforms to allow any promotion of natural medicines, this bill threatens to silence valuable education and harm reduction efforts, as well as the sharing of personal experiences that help to destigmatize and promote responsible personal use. The bill unanimously passed its first vote in the Senate Business, Labor, and Technology Committee, advancing to the Appropriations Committee. The vote came after lawmakers heard 2.5 hours of testimony from stakeholders, including 3 Colorado parents who reportedly lost their children to overdoses from drugs purchased on social media. Chelsea Congdon Brundage said her 19-year-old son, Miles, was injured during his sophomore year at the University of Colorado Boulder. He bought Percocet on Snapchat to manage the pain, but didn't know it was laced with enough fentanyl to kill 3 people, she said. Miles died instantly in November of 2020. He's gone now, forever, Congdon Brundage told lawmakers. I'm here today to remind you that real families and real children and your children are all struggling against the unbridled influence of social media, and it may cost them their lives. Another piece of legislation, House Bill 1136, takes a different approach to managing youth social media use. If made law, the bill would require social media sites to display pop-up notifications to users under 18 who are on the platform for over an hour or who are on it between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., beginning in 2026. The pop-ups would have to include data on the mental health impacts of social media use for young people, which would be collected in a resource bank. It's not different than putting a warning label on a pack of cigarettes, bill sponsor Judy Amabile tells Westword. Colorado lawmakers aren't the only legislators looking to change how young people engage with social media. Many bills have been introduced in Congress regarding protections for children and teenagers online, including the Kids Online Safety Act, which is expected to be voted on soon. If made law, the bill would require online platforms to take reasonable measures to prevent harm to minors, including online bullying, harassment, and sexual exploitation, and let young users limit or opt out of features like personalized news feeds, notifications, and auto-playing videos. Florida just passed a law to ban social media for people under 14 and require parental permission for minors aged 14 and 15. A number of states, including Georgia, Louisiana, Arkansas, Texas, and Utah, have recently passed laws requiring parental consent for children to use social media, though some of the state laws face legal challenges. In Colorado, even with all these bills on the horizon, more are expected to come. It isn't going to fix everything, but it is going to help our kids do better, says Amabile. It's a first step, and we'll be back next year with some other steps. This Must Follow Denver account spotlights local talent by Juliana O'Claire. The Hail Denver Music Instagram page boasts a collection of clips that peek into the artistic stylings of musicians from all over Denver. Some show indie and folk artists strumming softly on acoustic guitars, while others are shots of musicians mixing electronic beats and pounding on keyboards. But each of the videos makes one thing abundantly clear. Denver is ripe with musical talent, and Ryan Lavelle, the man behind the camera, knows how to capture it. Lavelle, a musician himself, has been playing the guitar since he was 14. In 2013, he moved from New Orleans to the Mile High City to be closer to his family, and he's been entrenched in the Denver music scene ever since. A ska expert and multi-genre dabbler, Lavelle is in a melodic punk group called Hotel Bar, as well as the country ska band Skank Williams, and often covers guitar, keys, and vocals. In 2023, Lavelle got his hands on a professional camera, and his interest in videography bloomed. In the past year, he's done promotional videos for friends who host podcasts, and educational clips about a local mushroom farmer. In February, he even began working on a horror movie. I've always wanted to do videography, so I just started learning, just looking at YouTube stuff and learning how to color grade, he says. I always had a fun time making movies and stuff in high school, so I picked it back up and started learning how to do it again. I thought it would be fun. In June, inspiration struck for another filming project, helping other local musicians promote their music online. I knew a lot of really awesome musicians around town, and I feel like a lot of singer-songwriter types are bad at promoting their own music. They kind of need a little nudge to get them to make something cool, he explains. That's really the whole thing, he adds. I have a lot of respect for musicians around town, and I have a good time doing it. Now he rolls around Denver filming performances with professional cameras and microphones for free, and then edits and uploads the clips to his Hail Denver Music Instagram. Lavelle's first video showcased Ian Gossman, the drummer of Hotel Bar and a longtime friend. Eventually, other Denver musicians caught a whiff of his project and began to reach out. Each video is simple and honest, a straightforward shot of a musician sharing tidbits of their work and life. Lavelle records the videos in the artist's home, capturing them in the environment that is the most comfortable and genuine. Aesthetically, it's fun to go into their space where they actually spend a lot of their time during the creative process, he says. He sets up lights, shoots a couple of quick test takes, and then gives the musicians free rein. He asks them questions while he's setting up, and clips of their playful chatter serve as the video's introduction. It's fun for me to ask them questions about how they started and how long they've been doing it and the types of things that they've been up to and the projects they're in, he says, adding that he gets to know each artist better through the filming process. One of the most interesting conversations was with musician and songwriter John Hyde, an old friend of Lavelle's. The pair spent some recording time chatting about kids, family, and how life unfolded as they aged. A lot of these people are closer to my age as well, says Lavelle, who is 38. That was an interesting conversation with Hyde, just learning how music can fall off the wall and to the side for a bit when your life changes so much. Hyde loved playing music, and it was awesome seeing him get back into it. The project is about publicity, but also a celebration of self. It's hail yourself. Look at you going out there and making stuff and doing things. It's all about showing that appreciation, like exalting your friends and saying, you're awesome for doing what you do and sticking with it, he says. Like, hell, you kick ass. Lavelle records as many songs as the musicians want, publishing one on Instagram and giving the rest to the artists. He promises that as long as artists are interested, he'll keep the project running. I just hope that people can watch them and gain appreciation for the musicians around their town, he says. There's so many other projects and larger touring acts and things that can suck the air out of the room for people who are just as talented, if not more so, that'll just be playing at Lion's Lair that night. Pointing to algorithms on streaming platforms like Spotify, Lavelle believes changes in music consumption are responsible for constantly pushing big names to listeners' ears. Hail Denver is a fresh reminder that unimaginable talent lies behind the doors of small local venues such as High Dive, Lion's Lair, and the Mercury Cafe, too. People really appreciate it when someone takes the time to show them that you care, he says. Musicians work really hard on their songs and what they do, and people appreciate you taking the time out of your day to make it about them and their stuff and show that somebody's listening and somebody cares. Follow Hail Denver on Instagram and YouTube. A fresh take on Jane Austen's Emma comes to the Denver Center by Tony Tresca. The award-winning actor-playwright Kate Hamill has once again demonstrated her genius for turning classic literature on its head with Emma. This production, which begins previews at the Wolf Theater on Friday, April 5th, before its opening on April 12th, promises a delightful blend of classic and contemporary, infused with Hamill's signature wit. I'm on a mission to adapt all of Jane Austen's work in the order she wrote them, minus Juvenilia, which I probably won't do, but who knows, says Hamill, who's based in New York. I wanted to write Emma specifically because I thought it was a really interesting portrait of a woman with a lot of intelligence, fashion, fire, and capability in a time before she was allowed to work. She's sort of a border collie without any sheep. Emma has ambition and go-getterness, but she has nowhere to put it. As Hamill thought about what form the play should take, she says she remembered that screwball comedies are all about what happens when somebody puts all their energy in the wrong places. So I began writing Emma as a wild, wacky, fourth-wall-breaking madcap comedy in the style of I Love Lucy and Hello, Dolly. Emma is modeled on those slightly flawed yet relatable heroines that the audience both roots for and sees getting into scrapes, Hamill says. I believe there's no point in adapting anything unless you're creating something that brings a lot of your viewpoint to it. I came at it from a new play approach, so it's a collaboration between myself and Jane Austen. I don't worry about being dramaturgically rigid. I focus on creating a new thing that celebrates being a play and is not a recreation of a novel. Based on Austen's novel published in 1815, Emma follows the adventures and misadventures of Emma Wodehouse, a clever, wealthy, and somewhat meddlesome young woman in early 19th century England. She takes it upon herself to play matchmaker for her friends and acquaintances, which often leads to humorous misunderstandings. Along the way, she must navigate her own romantic revelations with her longtime friend, George Knightley. As Emma embarks on a journey of self-discovery, she learns the value of genuine love and friendship, as well as the dangers of meddling in others' lives. We knew that we wanted to create something joyful while also getting to some real sources of female frustration and rage, Hamill explains. One of the premises of Emma is that Emma was born at a time when women, even privileged ones, have very few rights. There is both joy and frustration in her banging up against this crystal ceiling. The Mile High premiere, presented by the Denver Center Theater Company, boasts a talented cast, including Amelia Pedlow in the titular role and Broadway's Carmen Lacevita as George Knightley. It's directed by Meredith McDonough, with whom Hamill has twice collaborated on Emma, including for its world premiere at Minneapolis's Guthrie Theater in 2022. The production's design elements blend classic Regency-era style with contemporary anachronistic touches. We wanted to make sure that everyone had access points, McDonough says. If you're an Austenite, there are lots of little cookies there for you. If you've never read Jane Austen in your life, maybe Madonna's Material Girl is your entrance point. Clueless is another adaptation of Emma, and nothing in the world looks like Clueless, but energetically it's similar. The collaboration between a playwright and director can often lead to unique interpretations of a script. Such is the case with Hamill and McDonough, whose work on this production has culminated in a special director's cut of the play, distinctively tailored for her vision. I have a version of the script that is just for the production that Meredith directs, informed by her music choices, Hamill says. I also incorporate an alternate scene that only Meredith versions get to have. We're all very grateful to the Denver Center for bringing us together again, because I was able to work on the script and we changed some things, like the beginning of the act. Hamill adds that she wanted to stage the show in the area because of how smart and open-minded Colorado's theater-going audiences are. Denver has a great new play festival here and is less traditionally minded, she notes. I think they appreciate the classics, but are willing to see new perspectives, and that is a credit to the great work that Denver Center does. Audiences are going to enjoy how Emma is a new work and not trying to be some museum piece. In addition to bringing people to the theater for an irreverent take on a well-known story, Hamill hopes Emma will challenge audiences' perception of women as well as invite a more inclusive conversation around classic literature in today's world. I hope people come away with less judgmental attitudes about ambitious women, because we still live in a society where people are very judgmental of these quote-unquote unlikable women in stories, Hamill says. Emma is a play in which women are allowed to be fallible, messy, and crazy. They don't have to be sexy. Granted, our cast is full of beautiful humans, but it's not catering to some foreign gaze. It's complicated female friendships and watching women enjoy eating, gossiping, dancing, and flirting. Emma begins previews Friday, April 5th, opens Friday, April 12th, and runs through Sunday, May 5th. Wolf Theater, Denver Park Performing Arts Complex, 1400 Curtis Street. Get tickets at denvercenter.org. Fiddler's Green 2024 Schedule, Billy Strings and More by Emily Ferguson. Fiddler's Green Amphitheater has been Greenwood Village's haven for live music and arty events since it was created in the early 1980s by the Museum of Outdoor Arts. Developer John W. Madden, who founded the facility with his family, passed away earlier this month. He left quite a legacy with Fiddler's. After hosting more casual concerts and festivals there for a few years, the venue received an upgrade with fixed seating, an updated stage and sound system, and more, and officially opened in 1988. Another update followed a few years ago. Now, the amphitheater is known for pulling in big-name touring artists, rivaling even Red Rocks with its lineup. And 2024 is proving to be a big year for the venue. Billy Strings announced that his only Colorado tour dates for 2024, so far, will be at Fiddler's in May. And Noah Kahan will also play a two-night run at the amphitheater. Thank you for joining us for Denver Metro News. My name is Dave Dell.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.